to cause hill fog and some patchy drizzle through the day, but there will be some brighter spots to the south of the area where we could hit 14, otherwise 8 Celsius with one or two showers. And for the East Midlands, East Anglia and the South East, none of the fog that we saw yesterday, a dry and bright day in store, an isolated shower possible and highs of around 22 degrees. But air quality will be lower than it was on Tuesday. Mairead.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Taylor there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, our book of the week, The Unexpected Professor by John Carey. It charts the early years and literary experiences of a child from a socially isolated family who gradually found his way towards a wider world. Tonight's episode finds the author during wartime at a small school in Nottinghamshire. The reader is Nicholas Farrell.
At West Bridgeford Grammar School, the staff were bright and well-meaning, but I had no interest in the things they wanted to teach, history, geography, mathematics, which seemed abstruse and far removed from any concern of mine. Naturally, this annoyed them, and I was put on daily report. This meant that at the start of each week I collected a card, a white sheet with a black grid of little boxes like a cage. And at the end of each lesson, I had to walk up to the front of the class and ask the teacher to fill the appropriate box, reporting on my scholarly progress or lack of it. It was shaming, and I suppose meant to be. I coped by retreating into a sort of numbness, sealing myself off so far as I could from everyone around. I was helped by a book that I got from the school library, which I think a sympathetic teacher must have chosen for me. It was Henry Williamson's Tarka the Otter, and I liked it because there were no people in it, or only incidentally as enemies. With the very first sentence, I was far away from West Bridgeford. Twilight over meadow and water, the eve star shining above the hill, and old Nog the heron crying "Crack" as his slow dark wings carried him down to the estuary. I read it and reread it, not wanting to try any other book. Its fierce, cruel action made me feel secluded from everyday realities, and I realized that everything I had read before was trivial by comparison. I knew nothing about politics, so I had no idea how lucky I was that Williamson's books had not been banned from the school library because of his membership before the war of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. It was many years before I found anything to match Williamson's masterpiece, not in fact until I read the poetry of his great admirer, Ted Hughes. In 1947, we moved back to our house in Barnes. London was still in shock from the war. One day my father took me up to the city with him. From the top of the bus, we watched gutted, boarded-up ruins go by, and patches of wilderness with neatly piled rubble. I had no idea what it had been like before the war, so I felt nothing much except mild curiosity. What my father felt, I can't imagine. At St. Paul's, we stood on the cathedral steps and looked out. In front of us, no buildings remained, only a wasteland, pitted with deep square holes that had been cellars. Temporary brick walkways had been constructed across and around them. There was no traffic. Purple spikes of rosebay willow herb wagged in the wind. Richmond and East Sheen Grammar School for Boys was less pretentious than West Bridgeford. The headmaster, H.H. Shepherd, a mathematician and First World War veteran, had been in charge since its foundation in 1927. He was a wise, quiet man, a music lover and amateur botanist, and the masters he had appointed were the kind of people who change you for life. It was a small school, about 400 boys, with an average class size of 30, and we were divided into A and B streams. I was put into the B stream, no doubt due to the dire reports emanating from West Bridgeford, but was moved up to the A stream after a couple of weeks. That was because I had started to work. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was the teaching, or the chance to make a new start, or just being able to see things. Shortly after we got to London, an optician tested my eyes and prescribed glasses. I remember him saying,
You've been missing rather a lot, young man. But I suspect what weighed with me most was competitiveness. I had never felt it before, and perhaps it was related to the onset of puberty. The boys who regularly came top enjoyed a kind of legendary status. People whispered how brilliant they were. And I think the same ingrained skepticism that had made me resist the well-meaning teachers at West Bridgeford now made me feel that I could surely knock these local heroes off their perches if I worked. So I worked. Of course, working to come top would have been barren if it hadn't developed into working because I enjoyed it. But it soon did. And I discovered that what I really liked was poetry, which, apart from hymns and the Bible, had rather passed me by till then. A turning point was reading G.K. Chesterton's Lepanto, with its battering rhythms and dazzling historical vistas. White founts falling in the courts of the sun, and the Sultan of Byzantium is smiling as they run. There is laughter like the fountains in that face of all men feared. It stirs the forest darkness, the darkness of his beard. It curls the blood-red crescent, the crescent of his lips. For the inmost sea of all the earth is shaken with his ships. They have dared the white republics up the capes of Italy. They have dashed the Adriatic round the lion of the sea. And the Pope has cast his arms abroad for agony and loss, and called the kings of Christendom for swords about the cross. Lepanto is a poem glorifying a crusade against Islam, so you couldn't read it in school nowadays. But I thought it grand stuff, and still do, despite its politics. Our Shakespeare set texts were Twelfth Night, Antony and Cleopatra, and The Winter's Tale. And the problem for me was what to say about them. Criticism seemed ridiculous. The only adequate response was to learn the best bits by heart, which I did. My favourite was Othello's suicide speech, "Soft you, a word or two before you go," which I would intone haughtily in front of my bedroom wardrobe mirror, wearing my red dressing gown, the nearest thing I had to Moorish garb, and plunging an imaginary dagger into my stomach at the end. It was a moving performance, and I thought, compared favourably with Laurence Olivier's and Vivien Leigh's Antony and Cleopatra. We had been taken to see it at the St. James Theatre in 1951, when we were in the sixth form, my first visit to a theatre. Not that Olivier and Leigh were particularly bad. It was just that, as often with Shakespeare, when actors start to waddle around and gesticulate, it seems absurdly inferior to what your imagination has created from the words on the page. Life outside books was fairly humdrum. We played football and cricket against other Surrey grammar schools. I was no good at either, but as ours was a small school, it was easy to get a place in the side. The big shock every Saturday morning was our first sight of the opposing team. They can't really have been much bigger than us, but they always looked enormous, slouching up the school drive with their colossal school sports bags stuffed with equipment. Away matches were even worse, because then you first saw them out on their school field, bowling whizzing deliveries at each other in the nets, or hoofing thunderous practice shots at goal. It has made me understand better that bit in the Book of Numbers where the Israelites send out spies to size up the opposition, in this case the sons of Anak, and the spies come back aghast to report that they are giants, and "We were in our own sight as grasshoppers." I'd guess the sons of Anak weren't that big, really. They were just visiting team size. We must have won some games, I suppose, but usually we lost, unlike the Israelites. Still, I did win one sporting event, the only one I ever have. At the end of the summer term every year, the whole school, except those with medical certificates, had to take part in a cross-country run in Richmond Park. The course was not long by today's standards, probably not much more than 5 miles. This meant that you had to go all out right from the start, particularly as there was a narrow track with a wall on one side soon after the start, where overtaking was impossible, and if you weren't ahead there, you might as well give up. I very much wanted to win in my last year at school and practiced by running the whole course several times a week. On the great day, we gathered in a pack, and there was a lot of sweaty pushing and shoving at the start. But at the end of the first mile, where the course left the road and climbed up a cinder track, I looked back, and there was no other runner in sight, just boys following the race on bikes. It was a marvellous feeling, like having wings on your heels. At the finish, the headmaster, Mr. Shepherd, was standing by the tape and murmured, "Well done, Carey." My mother, when I got home and told her I had won, said, "Well, that's what you wanted, wasn't it?" I felt let down at the time, but my parents' lack of interest in what I did was an advantage in a way, because I never felt pressured. Besides, they had other things to worry about. Bill's condition was getting worse. His glowering silences were more glowering and silent. His hands shook more, and he lost his job. Compared to that, having a son who had won a race can't have seemed important. Anyway, I wasn't much good, really. A few weeks later, a school team, with me in it, took part in a county junior cross-country event, and none of us came anywhere. The first three places were taken by Sons of Anak. Because I was staying on at school in the sixth form, I was expected to get jobs in the holidays to earn some money. My school friend Dennis Keane and I worked for one summer as sweepers in the Chrysler factory at Kew. The car workers were an interesting bunch. One of them knew whole swathes of Shakespeare by heart and would act out Shylock's "Hath not a Jew eyes" speech for his admiring workmates. Dennis and I made the mistake, though, of continuing to sweep for a few moments after the hooter had gone for the mid-morning break, and a union official ticked us off, accusing us of being in cahoots with the management. After that, we rather lost interest in sweeping. Instead, we discovered a sort of hangar stacked with huge piles of Dunlop pillow for car seats. It made a marvellous trampoline, and we used to leap around, trying to hover weightless in the air like astronauts. My sister Rosemary and I belonged to the Church Youth Club, which held talks and discussions and went on country rambles in the summer. It was at the youth club that I met my first girlfriend. She was called Heather. Well, she wasn't, but I shall call her that. And she worked as a trainee librarian. We both still lived with our families, so it was hard to be alone together, as we found we wanted to be. However, we managed as best we could. I had been brought up to believe that women were pure and would engage in sexual activity unwillingly, if at all, and it was a great relief to learn from Heather that I had been misinformed on this point. My mother was furious when she heard of the relationship and delivered a passionate tirade. "I was too young to have a girlfriend. I should be working for my exams, not messing around with women. Besides, her family were not of our class." I went to Oxford for the scholarship exam just before Christmas in 1951. People had told me it was important to apply to the right college, but I didn't even know what a college was or how colleges differed from the university. In the end, I chose St. John's because it had been Mr. Shepherd's college. 2 days after I got home, a letter arrived telling me I had won an open scholarship to St. John's College, Oxford. It was passed round reverently, but I don't think any of us understood at the time quite what it would mean. Perhaps my parents had an inkling, though. Their expressions of pleasure were subdued, as if they foresaw that this would take me away from them to somewhere they felt they did not belong. It was the same with Heather. She kissed me and said how delighted she was, but there was something like terror in her eyes.
Nicholas Farrell was reading from The Unexpected Professor by John Carey. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 2nd of April. The general synopsis at 1800. Low just west of Fitzroy, 984, expected just west of Seoul, 983, by 1800 Wednesday. New low expected Biscay, 996, by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. West Viking, variable 4, becoming southeasterly 4 or 5 later. Occasional rain or drizzle, moderate or good, occasionally poor. East Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra. Easterly or southeasterly 4 or 5, becoming variable 4 in north at Sierra later. Occasional rain or drizzle, moderate or good, occasionally poor. 40s, Cromer.